The first case this morning on the en banc calendar is Southwest Gas Corporation versus Public Utilities Commission of Nevada and State of Nevada Bureau of Consumer Protection, case number 80911. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Your Honors.
Mr. Poulsenberg, could you repeat that? It was hard to hear you the first time.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
A little bit better. It's still a bit, the sound is still a bit low.
Let me see what I can do.
No, that's better. Thank you. And Mr. Agesti, can we hear you?
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Good morning.
Mr. Fox?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Okay. Ms. Grenier?
Good morning, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you. Much better. Thank you very much for all of your participation virtually. Quite frankly, with the health issues, we thought it best to proceed in this manner. And best of all, we'd be able to see all of your smiling faces, even though you can't see ours. So, with that said, are you ready to proceed, Mr. Poulsenberg?
Your Honor, thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Chief Justice Hardesty, Mayor Dan Poulsenberg, for Southwest. This case involves the unique role of utilities and the unique manner we have administrative review of what they do. Utility, almost any other kind of administrative case, because here we're not just talking about an agency that resolves. We're talking about a utility that's allowed to manage its own business and that's regulated by the Public Utilities Commission of Nevada. Its job is to regulate rates, but not to manage the utility. And as a result, we're arguing a form of assumption of for incurring costs, and certainly certain costs.
Mr. Poulsenberg, would you halt the clock, please? We are continuing to have an in and out. We are successful in hearing you to a limited extent, and then not at all. So I'm going to ask, I appreciate your starting, but I would like you to start over. I apologize. Because I think there are several portions of your argument we have missed.
Is that any better?
A little bit.
Okay. No, it's what's the problem?
Maybe you should log out. Log back on.
Chief Jason suggested it might be an issue with his connection, but you know,
it does seem like that because it sort of goes in and out. But we always have constant picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, my sound and my picture are coming in two different ways into the system. Oh. Can you hear me any better now?
Yes. Thank you.
More consistent, woo. Yeah.
Well, I've never been accused of consistency before.
That's on the record. Thanks, Dan.
I think you could probably take judicial notice. So this case is about the unique role of utilities. Unlike other administrative agencies, when the PUC comes to a utility, it simply regulates rates. It does not manage the business. As a result, there is both a sense of prudence for the business decisions that are made, not unlike the business judgment rule, but there's also a prohibition that the commission cannot substitute utilities judgment. Cannot ignore expenses incurred by the utility. You know, the agency's review of the utility is like a regular review of an administrative agency. While, of course, administrative agencies, in a real sense, the commission here has to defer to business decisions made by a utility. And see, that's why I think the PUCN has an improper impression of its task. It says that its role, at page one of its answering brief, is to ensure ratepayers are protected from a utility's incompetence and mismanagement. Well, certainly the agency has to balance and the shareholders, but it cannot assume mismanagement or incompetence, and I think that's what they did here. I put forth that the presumption of prudence in ordinary management by a utility, and in our brief, they take us to task, as we said in the brief, that the commission has always applied a presumption. Well, you know, I did rate cases with Rex Jemison in the 80s and the 90s. It utilized a presumption of prudence. We had a witness that worked on cases. Applied it.
Mr. Paulsenberg, I'm sorry, but we are having a further interruption, and I don't want to deprive your client of the opportunity for the court to hear the full value of the argument.
Can you call in by phone or something and keep the video up?
Sure. We'll give that a try.
Okay, well, we can all speculate about what the causes are, but I don't think any of us are in a position to know. I would have to defer to Mr. Rickman in our office and the folks in Mr. Paulsenberg's office.
Connection.
Chief, Mr. Rickman informs that he believes it's Mr. Paulsenberg's connection. So, Mr. Paulsenberg, perhaps you could log out, log back in, and maybe that'll satisfy the situation. We'll be waiting right here. Coming back. Okay.
All right. Sound any better now?
A little bit. We'll why don't we continue to test this a bit. Could you say something else, Dan, like how much you enjoy the arguing in front of the Supreme Court?
Well, I've enjoyed the 281 arguments before this a lot better than this one.
I think it's better, Dan. Let's give it a go. You were about to comment on the presumption issue, and that is an important one. Maybe we could begin there.
Very good. So, as I said, we took the position that the commission has always. Give me a second. Abe, there's something on the screen. Oh, I see. All right, we're trying to set up phone audio and see if that will do any better. So the presumption goes back to Southwest Bell, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and Brandeis's concurring opinion, where he says every investment may be assumed to have been made.
At his office on the phone.
We've got the phone now, too. Can we turn this off?
Stop the clock.
All right, can you hear me now?
Yes, uh-huh.
I'm not sure I'll be able to hear you. Just a second.
Can you hear me, Mr. Paulsenberg?
Just barely.
Yeah. Can you hear me at this point, Dan?
A little bit. Let me turn this on.
Yes.
Well, you'll get feedback if you do that. I think it's all the way off. But...
You want it off?
The sound coming from you is much better, at least appears to be.
Good. Well, I'm on Abe's phone. So maybe.
No, we get echo.
Can you turn that?
So this seems to be a bit of a challenge. I wonder if it would be acceptable to all council if we defer until we can get this technicality squared away, and then we can reconvene. I don't want to waste people's time while we're trying to deal with this. And maybe Mr. Paulsenberg, your folks could connect with Mr. Rickman directly and see if there's some solution that can be worked out between
Great.
You
Thank
all.
You, Your Honor.
Of course. So we'll be in recess and at least for probably 10 minutes or so, or longer if necessary, to see what happens. We'll be bumping up against another argument, depending on how long this takes. That may require rescheduling of this, but we'll see if we can get this done yet today.
And I'm sure the petitioner in that other case won't mind.
And once again, I wasn't able to hear that comment.
Probably good.
Yo, just take it from me. It was funny. Thank you, Your Honor.
Jason, I'm not sure we need to record it.
Okay, Dan, go ahead and give us a whirl. Yeah, nothing. You can always call in on that on the phone number. I think that may be the best option. Still nothing from you. Nothing still. No, I could hear you. Go ahead and say something.
Can you hear? Well, we're using the same microphone. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we could hear you much better. What do you think, Matthew?
I can hear him now. Is it possible that we could, you know, maybe have a laptop as a backup, Mr. Polsenberg, just in case it cuts out again?
Can you hear us?
I'm hooked into a laptop.
Okay. You want to try to say a couple sentences to test it?
Tomorrow creeps in its petty pace from day to day.
That was all smooth and clear. Oh,
that was smooth and clear.
Jason, you heard it smooth and clear?
I did, yes.
See, with the other counsel, when they talk, it just about it's so loud it blows me out. And then with the court, I just hear them regular, a little quieter regular.
Are your speakers on really loud or?
Abe says, yeah. So, does this have a volume? Where? Is it? All right.
Well, Dan, this is from the Las Vegas courtroom. Is it different? Is Chief Justice Hardesty is here. I just want to make sure there's not some sort of difference between the Carson and Las Vegas courtroom.
Elizabeth, you, Jason, let me see if you come out the same
testing
way.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
I hear both of you. Great. Can you hear me?
We can. I felt that you did just cut out again, so go ahead and give me another good sentence.
I heard a little glitch in there, too. How about now? Do you have trouble hearing me now?
Can you read a passage from Shakespeare?
I can't read it, but I can just do it tomorrow.
Yeah, that'd
tomorrow.
Be great. We need a few sentences.
Petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life is but a poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot. Full of sound and fury, signifying
nothing. Yeah, that sounds good.
What do you think, Elizabeth?
Elizabeth, I can't hear you well.
Can you hear me now?
Wow, yes.
Okay.
Elizabeth, we did hear a lot of paper shuffling.
When the court, there was a lot of paper shuffling. So Abe's hypothesis... Yeah, I'm not even
and this
sure.
is all my fault.
I'm not even sure it qualifies as a hypothesis.
Was it a paper shuffling from Dan or paper shuffling from the court?
from the court. Abe's hypothesis is that noise coming from the justices' microphones was cutting off my microphone because my microphone and my speaker are in one thing.
Okay. Okay. I'll ask them to not shuffle papers.
Well.
Or just, we think that may be the problem, so.
Well, I have no idea whether that's the problem, but it reminds me of that Chief Justice Young used to say, you know, we're right because we're final.
Should we give it a shot?
Okay, I'm going to go tell them we think we're ready.
Okay.
Okay, they will be back in a moment. If we can make sure all of you are on mute if you're not speaking. And it looks like all of you are except Matthew. So if you could mute, that also helps. There you go. Okay. Dan, are you there?
Oh, I am.
Okay. All right. They're going to come back in a minute or two. Start it again.
What?
An alternate number possible?
Don't stand in front of the camera.
Court is back in session.
Please be seated. Thank you. So let's test the sound again. Ms. Grenier, hi.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Ms. Digesti.
Good morning.
Mr. Fox.
Good morning.
And Mr. Polsenberg.
Good morning, Your Honor. How's your day going?
Well, some might say better than yours, but I don't want to say that. This is a joke. We're on the record. But I do appreciate everyone's patience, and I want to recognize the fact that these technical difficulties do occur, and they're unfortunate, but nobody should feel bad about it. It is what it is. So we appreciate everybody's patience, and the court appreciates having the opportunity to argue this case. And since I'm the only accountant on the court, I really like this case. So let's move on.
Okay, good morning, Chief Justice. Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Hardesty. May it please the court. Dan Polsenberg for Southwest Gas. This case is at its fundamental level about the unique role of utilities. You all know I'm going to argue that there's a presumption of prudence. So where does that come from? Well, I could say it comes from 2006 Nevada Power case, that it comes from Ely Light, that it comes from Justice Brandeis's concurring opinion in Southwest Bell. But it really comes from the unique role that utilities have in our system, especially when we're talking about administrative review of utilities. The agency cannot substitute its judgment for business judgments made by the company. It's just like business judgment. And this court in March issued an opinion on the business judgment rule, which was even written up in publications at Harvard. But the same principle applies here, where a company makes a decision, it's presumed to be prudent. Now, it doesn't necessarily, I'm not married to the language of the burden or the presumption of prudence. Because it really comes from the idea that the agency cannot substitute its judgment for the utility. Now, the PUCN argues, or the Bureau actually argues, that the standard is in NRS 703-373, that the court cannot substitute its judgment. That's exactly the argument that the commission made. Really light. They said that their decision is clothed with the presumption of being correct, and this court still, because its judgment is a matter of expense for what the agency did. The PUC, on the first page of their brief, they argue that their job is to ensure that ratepayers are protected from utilities mismanagement. Apply for that to really, the burden is to balance the interests of the shareholders and the ratepayers. But if they're going to go to that extreme, they have to show mismanagement.
Mr. Polsenberg, this, if I could interrupt, the argument is a confusing one for me in some sense. Is it Southwest Gas position that NRS 703-373-11 is unconstitutional?
No, I just think it doesn't. Well, if we have to get to that, yes. And because I talk about the presumption arising not just out of the common law, but also from constitutional principles under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments.
So what would be the source? We've looked at the Joseph Stockyards case Is that the source? Is there some other analytic that provides a basis for finding a constitutional infirmity in that statute?
Well, we have to get, first of all, I don't think you, and it's the court's duty and my obligation to present issues that aren't constitutional that the court can resolve. So it's not really the constitutionality of the statute. It's what the correct burdens of proof are. You can still defer to the agency within the proper scope of its operations. And so there are some issues you would defer to the agency, but it wouldn't be, just like in Ely Light, it would not be that the agency could substitute its judgment for that of the utility.
But Mr. Polsenberg, if I may, good morning. Ely Light seems to be distinguishable here, though, because Ely Light was about armchair quarterbacking a business decision. Here, and I'll take it in the context of the pensions, they're not disputing, you know, that pensions are a business decision. Great. There's a cost to those, not disputing what they're going to pay them. The question is whether or not the set-aside is too great. That's not disputing a business decision. And I think that takes us outside of Ely Light.
Oh, I do think it is substituting judgment on a business decision. Yes, Ely Light was a situation where there was $12,000 in pension expenses, and the PUC said half of that should be borne by the ratepayers and half of that borne by the shareholders. And this court said, no, the decision how to handle those pension expenses is a business decision. Here I think everything that we're talking about in the challenged work orders comes to $50 million. I think those are legitimate business decisions, and they could only be set aside with substantial evidence that they were imprudent.
Well,
and there's no evidence.
Mr. Polsenberg, isn't it your client's burden when coming in asking for a raise in rates based on having incurred those expenses to show that they were reasonably incurred?
Well, okay, Ely Light says two different things. and realize I think the court was it was not as good at writing decisions in 1964 as it was in 2006. So there's this one provision where the court has four dependent phrases. It says that the commission should not substitute its judgment for management in the absence of abusive discretion, in the absence of showing lack of good faith, if the amounts are reasonable and actually incurred. So the parties have been focusing on whether we have a duty to show that something, a prima facie duty to show that expense is reasonable. Honestly, that's not the holding of Ely Light. The holding of Ely Light is that there is a presumption of the proper exercise of judgment. And that matches with Brandeis's concurring opinion in Southwest Bell, where Justice Brandeis said an investment is assumed to have been made in the exercise of reasonable judgment. So do we have
so is that yes, they have to show it was reasonably incurred, or no, they don't have to show it was reasonably incurred?
I think that when you're looking at, I mean, remember, this was a 277-page order, you see, our showing was huge on everything. I think to make a prima facie case, we just have to say, this was a business decision, and it was actually incurred. And then I think the other side has to present evidence to show that it was not reasonable. And that's what happened here on some of the expenses. You know, I'm bound to hear about backhoes and massages. But when any of the interveners or the staff challenged any of those expenses, yes, we withdrew those. Because they were not reasonable.
Well, yeah, but Mr. Polsenberg, that's fine that your client withdrew the ones they specifically pointed out, but doesn't it, I mean, are you saying it's their duty and just whatever they point out, we'll withdraw and then we're good? or don't they have an obligation to look at those expenses initially and make sure all of them are appropriate?
Well, I think that's too. I think that's too much of a burden for a prima facie case, Judge. I think that would require us to have to detail every single subline item of the projects. So I think, as the Idaho court said, that a prima facie case for reasonable costs for to non-affiliates, so in other words, our arm's-length transactions, is achieved simply by showing the occurrence. Now, realize the challenges here, outside of the line items that we agreed to withdraw, were on principles like, well, this may not have been the lowest cost, or it there could have been a more appropriate alternative. I mean, these really are hypothetical questions. They're like, could have been. So I don't think in those circumstances where they're just questioning, not presenting any evidence, that they've rebutted the showing where we've come in and they have it where the commission's raised questions. Nobody's challenged it. I think under those circumstances, I think we have made a prima facie case. And I think that ties in with both of the things I'm saying. I think for the way to make the presumption work is to have us present a prima facie case, which is, look, I mean, we made the business judgment. I mean, look at the challenge work orders. Look at the FMS
software. Mr. Polzenberg, we've kind of come back to, I think, to presuming that we've adopted your request, that there's a presumption. And that's not what we are. I mean, I think you're asking this court to put in a presumption of prudence, right?
You know, honestly, I think it's a matter of semantics when you get through the answering briefs and then get to our reply brief, where they're coming in and saying, look, these are two different things, the rule that there's a presumption of prudence and the rule that you can't substitute the judgment for the agency. I think they work the same in this case. And so it isn't that I've conflated them. Look what the Bureau says on page 59 of their brief. The substitution of judgment rule is an inherent part of the Commission's standard of review and is applied in every case. The PUC must recognize each expense made by the utility and cannot disallow or deny a request for expense without substantial evidence of inefficiency or improvidence. That's the substitution of judgment rule, and nobody's disputing that at least that applies. And that operates the same way here. So the managers, I think, you look at Western Ohio, you look at Southwest Bell, the managers are presumed, we do have the presumption, I mean, it's an Ely light, that there is the presumption of the proper exercise of judgment.
Well, what would it take to rebut that presumption then? Isn't the list of concerns that they raised, wouldn't that be enough to rebut it and put the burden back on your client even if there were that presumption?
No, concerns wouldn't be enough. It has to be evidence. Well, they would have to go. Let's look at the software. The parties only challenged 0.5% of those expenses. All right, and then they came up with the position saying, "Well, you know, we don't trust." They basically, what they argued to the district court is, "We don't trust Southwest Gas, so disallow 50% of their expenses in these five projects." And then the commission went and disallowed 100%. Now,
subject
that is
to
not
renewing.
And we did renew, and they did find them prudent in a subsequent proceeding.
Okay. So is it moot?
No, it's not moot because that would only apply from the time of that approval.
Got it. Okay.
So under Nevada Power, the 2006 case, they have an obligation to show, to go into every expense, expense by expense. They can't show just colossal management errors. Great quote. That's from Nevada Power. And so here there were some colossal errors in booking.
Didn't the legislature essentially overrule Nevada Power? I mean,
they only overruled in AB 7, they only overruled Nevada Power in deferred energy accounting cases. Now, Nevada Power was a deferred energy accounting right. case, but even after that, the PUC continued to use the presumption of prudence in general rate cases. So AB 7 only applied to a context that we're not in. I'm just trying to find my notes on that, make sure I got everything. So so let me use interchangeably. They say I conflate the two concepts. Let me now say absolutely they're the same thing, the way they operate in this case. So where does the presumption come from? Yes, I think it comes from Ely Lake. The court talks about a presumption that comes from I think Nevada Power, the 2006 case, this court recognized the presumption of prudence. It recognized it in a deferred energy accounting case, but it relied on proceedings in the PUC, which weren't limited to energy deferred energy accounting cases. And in fact, when this court explained in some of the things in Nevada Power, it relied on a PUC proceeding in Ray Nevada Power Company, which relied on a FERC proceeding in Western Gas, which was a general rate case. So they do make, and what FERC said in that case is that it is presumed where there is no evidence to the contrary, actual expenses reflect good faith and prudent management decisions.
But we haven't adopted FERC standard.
You have not adopted it outside of deferred energy accounting cases. But what I'm saying is that we have, you know, I don't know if you heard me the first two times I tried to say this, they try to take us to task by saying that there's always been a presumption of prudence. But I did rate cases in the 80s and the 90s with Rex Jemison, and there was the presumption of prudence. We had a witness who testified over 20 years. The PUCN always applied the presumption of prudence. So it is the background by which we operate.
So, Mr. Polsenberg, regarding the discount rate issue, your client suddenly adopted a significantly different discount rate, which resulted in significantly more money being put out, which resulted in a request for a rate increase. And so your position is they just come in and say, this is what happened. And that meets the burden to warrant a rate increase unless they show it's not an appropriate rate?
Well, my argument works differently for the three areas. Certainly on the challenged work orders, I've got a hard and fast, they disallowed expenses without any proof. When we're looking at pensions and we're looking at the return on equity, the argument's a little more subtle. So the two issues for pensions, there were two issues. One was the test year versus normalization. So we were using 2018 as the test year, mm-hmm. and the commission, at the suggestion of the staff, used a normalization. Well, 2018 was a very high year, and so normalizing it with 2 years that were lower, it was not an accurate representation. So we had suggested using pension tracking. where we could go through the year and subsequent time periods and see what they actually turned out to be. So choosing, not going with that, I think, was at the very least arbitrary. As to the discount rate, realize what happened was nobody had challenged the discount rate beforehand. And so when we presented our evidence without anybody challenging it, we got questions about what the management's role was in adopting the actuary's recommendation of 3.75%. And so they asked for justification where there was no challenge. We had unanticipated questions. Realize the commission is not allowed to raise new issues under NIC 703-645, and that's what happened here. So I think in general the two positions that the commission took when it came to pensions intruded on management. They intruded on management because the Bureau said that tracking would not provide Southwest Gas with the incentive to control pension costs. Well, rate making shouldn't be behavior modification for the management of the company. And the commission actually said if Southwest Gas has concerns, it can take steps by revising the amount, type, and structure of pension-related benefits for employees. So in other words, what the commission is saying is if you don't like our approach, change the way you manage. When it comes to the challenged work orders, look, I have a real problem with that. I mean, this is my hard and fast argument. It's the easiest argument I can make. That no party challenged anything but 0.5% of our costs, and they wiped out all the costs. Nobody challenged need or asserted that they were overpriced. All they did was come in and say, based on some things, there must be a systemic problem. But you've got to look at these expenses one by one. And again, Nevada Power says a colossal management mistake cannot support denying the entire application. So it doesn't make sense for us to come in and prove every line if they're only going to challenge a few of them.
But aren't you then asking us to substitute our judgment for the PUC if they determine that the 0.5% that those concerns were sufficient to question the accounting methods and the judgment being used by the folks at Southwest Gas? Why should we substitute our judgment for that? There's evidence in the record to support them having questions.
Well, no, they have the obligation under Nevada Power to present evidence.
Yeah.
Not just to ask questions. They have to present evidence.
Right. So the evidence of the 0.5%, isn't that evidence that would cause concern?
No. It's not enough to deny the entire application under Nevada Power. They have to take it expense by expense. And look, the questions that they had are, well, why did you choose that timeline? Why did you choose that vendor? What were the alternatives? And nobody even mentions until our reply brief, we called the chief information officer of the company to come in and explain the decisions that were made. We went to these software programs. We went to Oracle, one of the best known vendors and manufacturers in the field. And we went to them because they had all the other software programs on our platform and they'd be compatible and interact. These were solid business decisions. And I'm not asking you to substitute your judgment for the PUCs. What I'm asking you to do is establish the correct standard of review the PUC should have utilized, and that's a matter of law. And explain to the PUC the way the business judgment rule operates and remand it to them. I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. All right. Who is going to proceed first?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Matthew Fox for Respondent PUCN. I'll be reserving 20 minutes for my argument, and then I will be moving to BCP, who will continue for another 5 minutes, and then NRI will conclude us with the remaining 5 minutes of the 30 minutes.
Very well.
I just want to clear up some things that Mr. Polsenberg identified in his opening argument. First, the Brandeis concurrence discusses what's referred commonly in the utility world as a prudent investment test. Now, this is a rate-making methodology that was explicitly rejected by the court in Duquesne as a constitutional standard for rate-making and valuing utility property. It's not a presumption of prudence. It doesn't conflate with a presumption of prudence. Again, it's a way that the utilities utilize to evaluate property. The second thing, and there was a lot of questions about the evidence regarding judgment on Southwest Gas's behalf. Respondents are in violent agreement with the appellant. The commission should not second guess, you know, evidence of reasonable utility management and judgment. But utility management, at least with respect to the challenge work order projects, wasn't available to testify. They weren't able to explain the reasonableness of the decisions that they made as they incurred expenses of upwards of $50 million. And then one last thing before I get into my main opening argument, Mr. Polsenberg made the suggestion that the 2006 case, which underlaid the 2006 case before the commission, which was then appealed up to the Supreme Court, was not a deferred energy accounting case, and that's just not true. Both of these cases dealt with deferred energy accounting. So, given the issues presented before this court and given the extensive briefing regarding the specific issue, the respondents posit that all of the issues in this case may be resolved through the proper application and consideration of Nevada law and two seminal decisions by the United States Supreme Court and Federal Power Commission versus Hope Natural Gas and Duquesne Light Company versus Barash. Now, again, given the extensive briefing on this issue, I'm going to address the appellant's proposition that the U.S. Constitution somehow confers upon public utilities a burden-shifting presumption of prudence that would abrogate their responsibility in Nevada rate cases to satisfy and sustain their burden of proof with substantial evidence when seeking to recover costs from captive ratepayers. Given that there has already been significant briefing on this issue, namely with respect to the analysis of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Southwest Bell, West Ohio Gas, Hope Natural Gas, and Duquesne, respondents submit to the court that these four cases harmonized together simply stand for the following propositions. One, a commission cannot second guess or otherwise substitute its judgment for that of the utility in the absence of a showing of improvidence or poor business judgment when the utility provides evidence of its reasonable management and prudent business practices. The Constitution does not prevent states from adopting laws that instruct their PUCs as to how to proceed and evaluate rate cases, and there is no constitutional standard for valuing utility investments or setting rates. Three, a commission's rate order must establish just and reasonable rates consistent with and reliant upon the substantial evidence in the underlying record. And finally, a utility seeking to overturn a commission's decision in a rate case carries a heavy burden of making a convincing showing that the total effect of the rate order is unreasonable, and a reviewing court, like this court, must end its judicial inquiry into a commission order if the appellant fails to meet its burden of proving that the end result of the entire rate order is unreasonable. So with these propositions in mind, I want to address the litany of cases offered in briefing by the appellant, presumably to suggest an overwhelming consensus regarding both the prevalence of the presumption of prudence and the recognition of the presumption of the Constitution. We can break down these cases into the following categories. Any of the state-level decisions address state-specific laws that govern the rule of practice and procedures in rate case proceedings before those respective jurisdictions. Respondents do not dispute that some of these other states have developed laws, whether through common law or statutes and regulations, that instruct their utility commissions on how to set rates, and that some of these states may be referred to as having a presumption of prudence as a rule of practice or procedure in rate-setting proceedings. Now, similarly, the FERC cases cited by the appellant simply address the manner in which a presumption of prudence may be applied in FERC proceedings, but notably when that same presumption may be eliminated as well. And of course, here I'm referring to the fact that FERC can eliminate the presumption and require utilities to establish reasonableness of their expenses and prudence of their business practices. Now, finally, the federal cases primarily relied upon by the appellant, namely Southwest Bell, which was decided in 1923, and West Ohio Gas, which was decided in 1935, simply hold that the commission cannot second-guess the judgment of utility management when it provides evidence of its reasonable management and prudent business practices. Operationally, in Nevada, this means that public utilities must contextualize the expenses they seek to recover from captive ratepayers with evidence of their prudent and reasonable management. And the commission must not substitute its judgment for that of the utility arbitrarily. Notably, and as an aside, because I won't discuss this case any further, this court has held a similar proposition in Ely Light, which, like the respondents, the underlying district court found simply stands for the same propositions provided in Southwest Bell and West Ohio Gas. Now, given the appellant's substantial reliance on West Ohio Gas, I want to explain what happened in that case, because it's clear that the respondents' plain meaning of the court's decision must prevail over the appellant's expansive inferences. In West Ohio Gas, the court overturned a commission decision to arbitrarily order a downward adjustment on the advertising expenses a utility incurred to procure new business because it disagreed with the utility that it was in competition with other gas providers. So the two things we can reasonably discern from these facts is that the evidence supported the utility's claim for advertising expenses, and the commission arbitrarily found these costs to be excessive and wasteful. What we cannot discern is that the court, in chastising the commission for substituting its judgment for the utility, somehow adopted a presumption of prudence as a constitutional standard, because nothing in this decision even remotely makes that suggestion. So when we read the plain meaning of Southwest Bell and West Ohio Gas, it's clear that the appellant fails to identify any language in any of these cases where a court has identified and adopted a constitutionally derived rule, practice, or procedure like the presumption of prudence. So as the district court stated in its order denying appellant's petition for judicial review, quote, collectively, the U.S. Supreme Court cases cited by the appellant provide that the PUCN should base its decision on the evidence before it, including determining whether a showing of inefficiency or improvidence has overcome assumed good faith or reasonable judgment on part of the utility managers, end quote. Now, the two cases upon which the respondents primarily rely, which are Hope and Duquesne, these are far more instructive to the issues presented in this case. In Hope Natural Gas, which was decided in 1944, the court abandoned the adoption of the fair value rule as the constitutionally acceptable method of fixing utility rates, recognized that other valuations, like Justice Brandeis's prudent investment test, may be utilized by commissions in setting rates, and provided explicit instructions to courts like this one regarding an appellant's heavy burden in overcoming the presumption of validity of a PUC's order. Indeed, the court in Hope held that a reviewing court such as this one is required to accept an agency's findings if they are supported by substantial evidence because commission orders are the product of expert judgment, which carries a presumption of validity. And a utility seeking to overturn a commission's decision or rate case carries a heavy burden of making a convincing showing that it is invalid because it is unjust and unreasonable in its consequences. The court also explained that the identification of piecemeal substantive errors or procedural infirmities is unimportant in its review of a rate order, holding as follows, quote, it is not theory but the impact of the rate order which counts. If the total effect of the rate order cannot be said to be unreasonable, judicial inquiry is at an end. The fact that the method employed to reach that result may contain infirmities is not then important. And notably, this end result test has been adopted by this court to determine whether PUCN decisions are just and reasonable. And as has been fully briefed, the respondents continue to contend that the appellant fails to demonstrate that the commission challenge order is unjust and unreasonable in its consequences. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court followed its decision in Hope with its decision in Duquesne in 1989. This decision in particular significantly contradicts the proposition that the presumption of prudence is rooted in the Constitution, given that the court discusses in detail the limited constraints the U.S. Constitution places on a state legislature's ability to instruct their utility commissions regarding the manner in which they should develop rate-making methodologies. Specifically, the court held that, quote, it cannot seriously be contended that the Constitution prevents state legislatures from giving specific instructions to their utility commissions, end quote, and that, quote, the Constitution within broad limits leaves the states free to decide what rate-setting methodology best meets their needs in balancing the interests of the utility and the public. Even when asked to adopt the prudent investment test as a constitutional standard for rate-setting, which, as I discussed earlier, the court held that the adoption of any such rule would signal a retreat from 45 years of decisional law in this area, which would be as unwarranted as unsettling, because the designation of a single theory of ratemaking as a constitutional requirement would unnecessarily foreclose alternatives which could benefit both consumers and investors.
Mr. Fox?
Therefore, it's not reasonable to claim that the presumption of prudence is rooted in the Constitution when the court in Duquesne explicitly discussed the limited constitutional constraints on state legislatures and their commissions in setting rates, found allegations of constitutional limitations on states' ability to develop rate-making methodologies as unserious, and never discussed or identified the presumption of prudence as being rooted in the Constitution.
Mr. Fox?
The plain meaning of... Yes.
I'm sorry, if I may.
Sure.
I want to just drill down a bit on a couple of issues. If we agree with you, there is no presumption of prudence, and we decline to adopt or we consider whether we are going to adopt same. The concerns Southwest Gas raises are, what do they have to prove in their case in chief? Do they have to prove the prudence of every single line item in their work orders? For instance, in this case, why wasn't Mirandu's testimony, why was that insufficient to justify the software products? They're saying, how can we're never going to be able to meet this. They're going to go down each rabbit hole, and in our case in chief, we're going to have to justify every turnover, every rock, and that doesn't seem workable from their perspective. What's really happening, and how would we address that concern?
Sure. So when we look at this case, what the commission is looking for is that the utility actually exercised reasonable judgment. So we're not looking at a line-by-line explanation. All of these expenses make up a business decision that the utility made. I'm not saying that there's one right answer. We're just asking for some insight into what judgment was exercised. And that just wasn't available in this case. Now, you mentioned Mr. Mirandu, but I want to take a step back because they have a responsibility under NAC 703.2231 to sustain their burden of proof when they file an application proposing to change their rates. So they offered one witness to support the $50 million worth of these costs, but this one witness wasn't involved in the execution of these projects. She didn't even look over the expenses that were submitted. So when we asked her to help, you know, provide some context regarding these expenses that they incurred, she deferred to Mr. Mirandu. And the problem with Mr. Mirandu's testimony is that, one, he wasn't necessarily qualified. He's an executive, but he arrived at the utility a year after these projects were closed. And his testimony can be basically summarized as looking at the same information that the staff witness looked at. And the staff witness, again, has nearly a decade of experience reviewing these types of expenses and simply came to a different conclusion. So it's not that the commission is asking for an unreasonable line-by-line explanation of every single expense. It just wants some insight that some level of reasonable judgment was exercised. And when it sees expenses like a golf membership, a natural gas grill, expensive dinners show up in the utility's case in chief, and the utility isn't able to explain how those costs were included or came to be included in their application, what level of oversight was applied to these projects, that becomes concerning to the commission. And yes, the identification of a half a percent of, you know, the $50 million that they're discussing, it is minute, but it's not the commission's responsibility to make the utility's case. The commission's responsibility is to ensure that whatever cost they seek to recover in rates leads to just and reasonable rates. And when we have such substantial evidence of mismanagement and a severe lack of oversight, and we don't have one utility executive available to testify regarding the management decisions that were made to incur nearly over $50 million worth of costs, the bar isn't that high.
Well,
right?
Mr. Fox, if there's a change in management, as not that unusual, can't the current executive testify based on the records and documentation that they have there in the company that he explained, he reviewed, he came in, he's now in charge, he wants to know what happened and what decisions were made? And I mean, do they have to bring back former executives that they no longer control?
And thank you for that question, Your Honor. That's not the expectation either. There should be some level of documentation regarding the business decisions that they made over the past decade. So the last time they came in for a rate case before this one was 2012. This rate case was in 2018. They decided to go out and spend $50 million. There should be some reasonable level of documentation regarding their exercise of judgment over the course of the program charter, the execution of the programs. So,
Mr. Fox, I apologize for interrupting your response. Go ahead and finish your response to Justice Kadish, but I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, so Mr. Mirandu or Ms. Cunningham could have reasonably reviewed the documentation of that exercise of judgment and then provided testimony to the commission regarding their understanding of the judgment that was exercised, but that wasn't available under this evidentiary record either. What the respondent or what the appellants have been pointing to is a program charter, but a program charter is basically set up at the beginning before any decisions have been made regarding the execution of the project. So what we want to see is what you set out to do, you actually did with reasonable judgment.
Mr. Fox, my question relates to a representation made by Mr. Polsenberg that in a subsequent case, these expenses were approved by the commission. Is that the case, and what's the difference in the proof between the two?
That is the case, and the difference between the two is that the utility provided substantial evidence to support its recovery of these costs. And notably, it wasn't Mr. Mirandu or Ms. Cunningham who testified in support of these costs. It was a completely different witness. So what the commission has done consistently is apply the evidentiary record to its governing law and results in typically recovery of these types of utility expenses when the utilities provide. Yes.
I have two other areas I'd like you to address. There may be others, but your time is running. First, the decision by the PUC to select the rate of return at, I believe, 9.25% or something like that, and then the decision to reduce the pension to 50%. It's not clear to me how those decisions were arrived at, other than a declaration like in the case of rate of return, the selection of the lower end of the range. I'm not sure that that's an adequate justification.
Sure. So substantial evidence exists to support the rate of return ultimately awarded by the commission to the utility, because the 9.25% ROE authorized by the commission was within the range of reasonableness set by the commission and within the zone of reasonableness recommended by two parties in this case, which are the Bureau of Consumer Protection and the regulatory operations staff. And the commission heard evidence that indicated that any number within that range was reasonable and that Southwest Gas's risk profile supported a return on equity in the lower end of the zone. So substantial evidence exists in the underlying record that does support the 9.25%. Now, Southwest Gas may disagree with the commission's selection, but that doesn't change the fact that the evidence still stands. And with respect to the discount expense, you know, Chief Justice, I think you'll appreciate this as an accountant. From 2011 to 2017, their discount rate never fell below an average of 4.75%. Then inexplicably, it lowers in 2018 to 3.75%, which is a 100 basis point difference. Now, without any explanation regarding this anomaly or this severe divergence from consistency, they offered a witness who was unable to explain the management decisions that led to such a significant divergence. And it's important to understand that there's an inverse relationship between the discount expense and the cost that would be borne by ratepayers. The lower the discount expense, the more ratepayers are going to have to pay. And in this instance, the drop of 100 basis points led to $4 million. So the commission reasonably had questions regarding why there was such a divergence after years of consistency. And the utility was unable to answer those questions either.
Okay, thank you.
So in closing, I see that my time is running out here, but the court must affirm the district court's order denying the appellant's petition for judicial review, reaffirm the commission's challenge final order because the presumption of prudence in general rate cases is neither rooted in the Constitution nor recognized in Nevada law, and because the commission's decision to disallow the expense associated with the challenge work orders set a reasonable ROE of 9.25% and normalized the utility's pension expenses are all supported by the underlying evidentiary record. And with that, I will yield the remaining time to 5 minutes for BCP and 5 minutes for NRA. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
May it please the court, my name is Whitney DeGesti, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Nevada Attorney General's Bureau of Consumer Protection, or the BCP. The BCP is tasked with representing the interests of Nevada ratepayers in utility rate cases pursuant to Nevada Revised Statutes 228360. And the BCP agrees with everything that Mr. Fox just set forth, and we ask this court to affirm the district court's order in this case in its entirety. This is a consumer protection, or even more particular, a ratepayer protection case. And we ask this court to recognize what we all know to be true, the parties on this side. There is no presumption of prudence in rate cases in Nevada. If there was a presumption of prudence found in this case, it would be making new law in this state. And it would be conflicting with current law in Nevada. That is, the three ways a presumption of prudence could be mandated in this state don't exist. Number one, there's no Nevada law that requires it. Number two, there's no Nevada Supreme Court case mandating it that still holds today. And number three, the United States Supreme Court has never interpreted that the U.S. Constitution requires that a rebuttable presumption of prudence, a procedural rule, be applied in every state utility rate case. In fact, as Mr. Fox pointed out, Nevada Administrative Code 703-2231 provides clearly that the utility bears the burden to show that its proposed changes are just and reasonable. And additionally, if you look at the entire statutory scheme of NRS and NAC 703 and 704, you'll see that the utility is required to provide certain evidentiary support for its expenditures in their initial application. And this makes sense because the utility is a quasi-monopoly and they are the applicant asking to raise rates for Nevada captive ratepayers. The utility makes profits based on the expenditures that the PUCN approves. So it follows that they should bear the burden of showing why rate increases are fair by presenting evidence that they spent money prudently. Additionally, I wanted to point out NRS 704-110 subsection 2 provides that a rate case must be done in 210 days. And that works out to actually about 60 days for discovery. So it makes no sense to have the utility, who is the gatekeeper of the evidence and the information that would show prudence, to not have to provide it to the other parties to the case right away. If your presumption of prudence was applied, it would change the way things are currently done. It would have the interveners, such as BCP staff, the large customers, have to pry the information away from the utility in order to, quote, prove imprudence. And the efficiency and the accuracy of these cases would significantly diminish due to the practical hurdles the parties would have to overcome in order to ascertain what expenses are just and reasonable. Additionally, and importantly, I want to point out, and I ask this court to take judicial notice, that in 2021 Nevada legislative session, Nevada legislature passed a law in SB 448 section 35 that there is no presumption of prudence in rate cases in Nevada. And Senator Chris Brooks, the sponsor of the bill, said it well. He said, if you're going to make investments and recover those costs, you must do so in a manner that you have to prove that the investment you made is prudent. It is a compact between the state, the utility, and the regulator. We allow recovery of that cost for profit, but in return, we need to make sure that they make the best investment on behalf of the ratepayer possible. So it follows, because there's no law requiring a presumption of prudence in Nevada, Southwest Gas can't simply claim a constitutional confiscation and get a certain review treatment. This is true for all of the reasons Mr. Fox set forth, but it's also true because the United States Supreme Court in Duquesne and in Verizon versus FCC, and that's 535 U.S. 467, they made clear that the utility must actually substantiate a constitutional taking claim through evidence of financial harm to the company.
Ms. DeGesti, before you conclude, could you clarify why the BCP recommended a rate of return of 9.3%?
Your Honor, that's based on a technical analysis. They looked at the proxy group. They looked at the other similarly situated utilities in the area, and they came up with that decision based on the technical experts analysis. And sorry, I'm going into other people's time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Agesti. Ms. Grenier.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, Laura Grenier on behalf of the Nevada Resort Association. The precedent this utility asked you to adopt would turn your rate-making process in Nevada on its head and put captive customers at risk of being forced to pay rates that are unjust and unreasonable based solely on the utility saying that it spent the amount identified. What they suggest would create due process concerns for customers to bear a burden of producing evidence that's solely in the control of the utility. To conclude that cross-examination raising serious doubt as to the reasonableness and prudency of expenditures is inadequate to require the utility to come forward with substantive information to respond. The $51 million on computer software exemplifies this. Mr. Polsenberg said parties didn't challenge anything more than one half of 1%. But, Your Honors, that's the very point of cross-examination in a due process hearing, is to uncover the weaknesses in the testimony that's been presented, which is what occurred here. Questions were raised about the lack of any evidence of any RFP, any bidding process, or any comparison whatsoever of the chosen vendor's pricing. Based on what Southwest Gas provided, there's no way for customers, the PUC, or this court to know whether the $51 million was 10 times or 100 times higher than a comparable vendor would have charged for a similar product and service. Is it not a fundamental requirement to show expenditures and costs incurred were reasonable? According to Southwest Gas, it's not. But would any of us think of spending $51 million without seeing how much the same software would cost from an alternative source? Southwest Gas cannot have it both ways. They argue they're not shifting the burden of proof to customers and other interveners. They say at page 11 of their reply that raising serious doubt is not equivalent to proving imprudence, and serious doubt is simply more than a bare allegation. Yet Mr. Polsenberg today argued that you can only set aside this presumption with substantial evidence of imprudence. So which is it, Your Honors? And it cannot be the latter, because the customers have no access to that evidence that the utility holds and controls. Here, with $51 million at stake, they argue that the only way to shift the presumption they want you to establish is to have evidence that costs were conclusively imprudent, like those that staff identified for massages and golf memberships. If in the face of questions about whether they did any sort of cost comparison to evaluate whether this vendor provided a reasonable market price, they provide nearly nothing. What more could a customer such as NRA's members establish to question the prudence? And how would a customer raise greater questions than this? In their reply, they faced with this question, Southwest Gas again cites to invoices and cost vouchers, and now limited testimony of Mr. Mirandu about one piece of the software, asserting that analysis was done with respect to possible vendors for the FSM portion. One piece, which he does, they don't explain, was a $10,000 of the $51 million or maybe something more. But nothing more or any suggestion that they presented even a scintilla of evidence to demonstrate that they did not significantly overpay for the $51 million in software at issue. Nevada statutes and the bedrock of rate making for captive customers of a monopoly require two things that this utility would have you ignore. First, that rates must be just and reasonable, and the circumstances here demonstrate that the PUC could not possibly make that finding on a record where the utility utterly failed to show that it couldn't have gotten a comparable product for, say, $5 million instead of $51 million. And two, the Commission's finding that a rate must be just and reasonable based on substantial evidence. Southwest Gas asks you to turn these rules on their head and force customers to somehow disprove reasonableness. They rely on case law that precludes regulators from substituting judgment. But here, there was no judgment. The case law does not speaks to a presumption of good faith and applies in an absence of inefficiency or improvidence. The facts here highlight the problem of what's proposed to you, because there was apparently a lack of any management decision. How could business management be considered without any cost comparison, without any RFP, on a $51 million expenditure? What they propose to you would be unfair to customers and deny due process. We respectfully request that you reject this proposal and affirm the district court in the PUC's decision.
All right, thank you, Ms. Grenier. Mr. Polsenberg, your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Look, this is not a methodology case. I know Hope Natural Gas and Duquesne Light take up two issues at the same time, and even Ely Light does. It's considering expenses and its methodology. This is not a methodology case where we look to the end results. What we're looking at is the method to determine the expenses we're entitled to. So we're not, in a way, there are elements of methodology that come into play, and I think Justice Kadish was touching on that when she was talking about the discount rate in the pension. But really, if we look at the return on investment here, they picked the low end of reasonable, 9.25, even lower than the Bureau, which started at 9.3 and then at the hearing suggested 9.4, but which was inappropriate under the circumstances because Southwest Gas has higher risk than the proxy group. But then when you also cut out $50 million of expenses, you drive that 9.25 down under 9.1. So you're outside the zone of reasonableness, which is why I'm saying it's confiscatory. It's the end result that we look to. So let me handle a couple other issues. These were thousands of work orders, each over $100,000. So for them to pick two or five and go line by line, if we were to anticipate that, we would have to have that same kind of incredible detail in thousands of work orders. In the subsequent case, we called Jose Esparza, who has a similar information position in the company, and he basically testified to the same things, and the commission accepted them then. They're raising questions about, well, did you need overtime to meet your timeline? Was your timeline? These are business decisions. Staff could have investigated that. Yes, 2021 Senate Bill 448 does say no presumption of any costs were prudently incurred. It's prospective only, and in Section 43.5, the legislature made clear it is not a clarification or statement of intent on prior law. So it's just like AB 7. It comes after this court's review of this case. Here's really what their position is, and one of the headings, the Bureau's reply brief at 87, while they're arguing that the commission's decision is based on substantive evidence, their heading actually says substantive lack of evidence. You know, the amici come in and talk about 12 times in their brief, they talk about, well, the commission would have to decide whether this was a necessity. It was undisputed that these software programs were necessary. And as the Supreme Court said in Duquesne Light, that you look to the reasonable decision to incur the cost irrespective of whether it was necessary or beneficial in hindsight. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing in this case. The case will stand submitted. The next case is scheduled to be heard at 11:30. We'll commence at 11:40 because of the previous delays. And thank you very much for everybody's patience this morning. We'll be in recess.